Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Tear gas has been thrown as well. There are flashbangs going off.
Refugees as the targets of chaos. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Anne Applebaum witnesses the violence and the political opportunism at the Poland-Belarus border. Then,
you're a major world leader, and so is the United States.
A high-stakes meeting between the world's two most powerful men. We discuss what was achieved amid the ongoing flashpoints. Also ahead, Hollywood heavyweight director J.J. Abrams tells me why he's turned to theatre after Star Wars, backing a British farce, The Play That Goes Wrong. Plus,
I feel that I can't just sit on the sidelines. This is the country that I love.
Rachel Vindman, wife of key impeachment witness Colonel Alexander Vindman, talks to Michelle Martin about leaving the Republican Party and her podcast, The Suburban Women Problem. Welcome to the programme, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Our focus tonight, a standoff between dictatorship and democracy. The first story takes place on the Poland-Belarus border, which erupted into chaos today. And caught in the middle are desperate migrants. Polish border guards used water cannons and tear gas to push back young men who were throwing rocks because these refugees' anger and frustration are now spilling over after weeks of being stuck in the freezing cold. Correspondent Matthew Chance was there as it all unfolded.
We're seeing these dramatic unfolding right now as we speak. Helicopters in the sky, water cannon firing right behind me here on the migrants who are gathered there with sticks and smoke. You see they're spraying orange pepper spray, throwing rocks towards the Polish border guards over there. I'm going to flip the camera around. Whoa, we're being water cannon here.
And the White House is calling on Belarus to cease its, quote, callous exploitation and coercion of vulnerable people. The EU says it is a calculated plot by the Belarus dictator to lure in migrants and dump them at the EU's doorstep in retaliations for sanctions that it imposed after Lukashenko stole the elections and violently suppressed the opposition at home. Anne Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and historian who saw firsthand what's unfolding at that border, and she's joining me now from London. Anne, welcome to the programme. You know, I want to ask you first, this is a callous attempt, as the White House says, but as we can all see, to use the most vulnerable people as political pawns in this struggle between the dictator and, you know, and the European Union and the West.
Yes, I think it's really important to have some context and understand how those people got there. These are people from all over the Middle East, particularly from Syria and Iraq. Many of them were promised an easy walk into the EU. They were sold visas at very high prices. I was heard $1,300 for a visa. Some paid big, you know, money for plane tickets, for a whole travel package, borrowed money from their whole family in order to go there. And they thought it was a promised way to get quickly to Germany or to Sweden or wherever they have relatives. Of course, this was a lie. The Lukashenko regime in Belarus is using them as a way of creating pressure on the European Union, particularly on Poland and Lithuania, which are two neighbors that have taken in a lot of dissidents from Belarus and have been very critical of the repression and violence that Lukashenko has used against his population in the past few weeks and months since he's, you know, stole and falsified elections last year. The Polish government has also tried to make politics out of this situation, which is not good either. They're treating it as a kind of war. But one of the results of that is that people have got caught in the middle, and there have already been some deaths. But the primary responsibility does belong with the dictator of Belarus, who brought people there on purpose in order for this to happen, as is preventing people from returning to Minsk and returning home.
So, Anne, you have studied this situation, you know, for a long time. You were at the border, and I'll ask for your firsthand assessment in a second. But this is, you know, part of this global struggle as autocrats rise and challenge democracy. And you've just laid it out. You, of course, and we have to say, are married to one of the opposition leaders in Poland, which you always write in your articles. But you've also written Why the Bad Guys Are Winning. That's your latest Atlantic article. Why are the bad guys winning, the autocrats, in your view?
Because it's important to see that Belarus is not a single state acting of its own volition. The leader of Belarus has full support from Russia. And in fact, as we may want to discuss, there are some suspicions that the Russians have put them up to this because they're interested in either in using it as a provocation or to hide the fact that they're bringing lots of troops to the border with Ukraine. Belarus is also the site of a major investment from China. Belarus has very developed economic negotiations right now with Iran. Belarus has been defended at the UN by Cuba. These are now countries that, although they have very different ideologies, you know, seemingly, you know, a theocracy in Iran, a nationalist dictatorship in Belarus, you know, a communist country in Cuba, actually they have very similar political systems and very similar goals. And all of them see democracy, democratic activism, but also the rule of law, and all, you know, language about human rights. They see all of that as a personal threat to themselves because that's, of course, the language that their own oppositions use. That's language that's popular inside their own countries. And so one of their goals is to seek to undermine democracies, and they do this in a wide variety of ways, but also to help one another. The state companies from one of these countries will invest in the state companies of another. They sell one another. They share surveillance technology. They share disinformation tactics. They use the same kind of anti-Western propaganda. So they act as a, it's not an alliance. It's not organized, but they very much act like a network. And unfortunately, Western countries, you know, the democratic world, I should say, because it's not all part of what the historical West, but the democratic world hasn't really come up yet with an answer to these kinds of tactics. You know, well, we're still surprised, you know, we're still acting like it's an ad hoc situation.
So now, as you're talking, we're showing these absolutely brutalizing pictures of these poor refugees, migrants, who, as you say, have been lured under false pretenses to be used as pawns in this game and are being attacked and are being, you know, as we know, for months they've been out in the freezing cold. There has been some attempt after the violence today by Belarus to move some of them onto some indoor shelters. But what is the West, in this case, the EU's possible response, or even the United States? Sanctions haven't worked. They don't work on Belarus so far.
We haven't really tried harsh sanctions against Belarus yet, actually. Okay. You know, we haven't shut the borders. We haven't cut off trade. We haven't cut them out of the international financial system. I mean, there's still a number of steps more to do. It's also important to understand, I mean, one of the nuances of this story is that although this has actually been going on since August, these, you know, the bringing people to the border happened mostly in smaller numbers starting in the summer. The Polish government did not ask for help from the EU. It did not ask for support from the EU. It hasn't done very much diplomacy. And it's really only as the situation began to become a crisis and an emergency, as the numbers of people became very large, that the EU became involved. And the EU has been involved. There have been European leaders have spoken both to Putin and to Lukashenko. Begun reaching out to them and to some of the agencies that are bringing people to Minsk from the Middle East, and they've got some of the airlines to stop flying. They've got some of the countries in the region to act, to offer to bring their citizens back. So there is some diplomacy happening now. It's just that it's happening late. You know, we always have these knee-jerk reactions to these situations. We haven't thought about them in advance. And actually, this kind of thing has been done before. The Turks have played this kind of game on the border with Greece. There are a number of other examples as well. You know, we need a playbook. You know, we need a set of reactions that we always have to this kind of situation, and not this chaos. And there is chaos on the Polish border. I was there last week, and there are people who've somehow made it through. The guards cut the fence for them, and there, you know, you find a Kurdish family camped in a Polish forest, totally disoriented, with no food or water. Eventually, many of them have been helped by local people who've organized kind of rescue, ad hoc rescue organizations. But it's very cruel, it's very chaotic, and it's very disorganized.
And in the short time we have left, just, you know, you were there, you talked to some of these migrants. What struck you the most from what they told you?
It's the naive hope or the belief that they're going somewhere better and that it's all going to be worth it. And of course, many of them, and some of them are genuine political refugees, and they will get some kind of asylum in the West, perhaps, if the right circumstances allow it. But really, having come illegally through the border and maybe not qualifying technically as political refugees, it's going to be very difficult for them. And I feel the tragedy is they've been lied to. You know, they've been offered, you know, this kind of visa to nowhere.
Yeah, caught in the middle of these big war games almost between our political systems. And thank you so much indeed. And now let's delve further into the global fight to preserve democracy against autocracy, because from opposite sides of the world, the US President Joe Biden and China's President Xi Jinping beamed into each other's offices for more than 3 hours of highly anticipated virtual talks overnight.
I think it's very important, as I've told other world leaders when they ask about our relationship, is that we have always communicated with one another very honestly and candidly, and it's we never walk away wondering what the other man is thinking. And I think that's an important ingredient for this relationship, to be open and candid in terms of our relationship.
But there were no breakthroughs. The meeting did open up communications between the world's two most powerful leaders. On the docket remain a number of flashpoints like Taiwan, trade and human rights. Here now to discuss from Beijing is Victor Gao, a former top official in the Chinese Foreign Ministry and now director of China National Association of International Studies. And from Maryland, Robert Daly, director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States. That's at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Gentlemen, welcome both to the program. Let me ask you first from Beijing, Victor Gao. You know that there's this they call each other old friend, or at least certainly your president called President Biden old friend. Nice to see you again, old friend. And President Biden, you know, not so long ago, when a journalist asked him about the old friend, he said, make no mistake, he's no friend of mine. This is all about business. How did all that go down, the opening, the initial dialogue between the two men in your state-run media?
I would say a virtual summit between President Biden and President Xi Jinping of China truly turned a historical page in the Chinese-U.S. relations. And the way President Biden and President Xi Jinping dealt with each other truly demonstrated the decency, the respect, and the cordiality that these two countries need to accord to each other. This is a truly important meeting. It gives all of us a collective sign of relief because it signals that despite of all the challenges and difficulties, China and the United States, from the heads of state down, should deal with each other, engage with each other to deal with all the challenges and pressure points and strive for common good, rather than getting onto each other's jugular. This is a landmark in our bilateral relations.
Okay, well, that's a pretty optimistic readout. So let me ask you, Mr. Daly, whether you agree with what Mr. Gao says and how the Chinese have read into this meeting. Obviously, the meeting itself, it's a good thing that it happened. They seem to have, you know, talked convivially. Where do you see the strengths and weaknesses of what took place during that meeting?
Well, it's certainly true that it's better that they talk than that they not talk. But I don't think this was a landmark or that a historical page was turned. I think it was a small, good step, but it wasn't a breakthrough. What we saw is that both Xi Jinping and President Biden would like to avoid conflict. They see more danger, especially in the Taiwan Strait, but they haven't yet demonstrated any willingness to change their perceived interests, their goals, their strategies. Each is searching for a formula that will get the other to accept the United States or China's prerogatives, and they haven't been able to do that yet. So there's urgency, there's concern, there's a will to talk, but there hasn't been any adjustment yet of policies from either side. And so we are pretty much where we were last week, except that now they're talking.
So let me ask you, because you mentioned Taiwan, and I'll put this obviously to Mr. Gao as well, because it is huge and it's been building for a long, long time. We report, we read now from the White House that the U.S. and China, their officials, will, quote, intensify communications and discussion on the issue of Taiwan. That came out after the readouts and after the summit. What needs to be done, Mr. Daley, on the issue of Taiwan? What does intensify communications and engagement mean to you?
I think it means that the Biden administration has to convince China, to reassure China, that we are still dealing with Taiwan within the framework of the One China policy. And this is going to be difficult because we interpret that policy differently. The United States takes a very minimal view. It means the One China policy for the Biden administration means that we recognize Beijing and only Beijing as the leader of all of China. But beyond that, we're going to sell China Taiwan arms. We're going to try to get it to have more international space, to have better trading relationships. We're going to work closely with Taiwan. China's version of what it calls the One China principle is that Beijing and only Beijing should determine how Taiwan interacts with the rest of the world. And we don't accept that. So we have to provide reassurance for Beijing, but it's not clear that we're willing to change any of our calculations to do it. So intensive diplomacy is exactly what we need.
So let me ask you the similar question then, Mr. Gao. From your perspective, from China's perspective, do you think the United States, certainly the president of the United States, allayed your fears and your president's fears over Taiwan? I'll just say what your president said. He has warned that American support for Taiwan was, quote, playing with fire.
First of all, I think President Xi Jinping just gave the message of simplicity, straightforwardness, and elegance to President Biden of the United States. Why? If we look at the issue of Taiwan, several things are carved in stone. Taiwan is part of China. If you read the Cairo Declaration, the Potsdam Declaration, which became pillars of the post-Second World War international order, then you know that Taiwan is part of China. Number two is that there was a civil war between the communists and the nationalists at the end of the 1940s, leading to fleeing mainland China to Taiwan by the nationalist groups under Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. That was a fact. And the current status between China's mainland and Taiwan is actually the unfinished civil war in China. Now, it is also a fact that back in 1979, the United States government abandoned Taiwan as an ally, withdrew all the U.S. troops stationed in Taiwan, canceled its diplomatic recognition of the Republic of China, and abrogated its defense treaty with Taiwan for what? For recognizing the People's Republic of China as the sole legitimate representative of China. That's all facts. Now, we just need to deal with this Taiwan issue within these historical guardrails.
Because otherwise, we cannot talk about this issue anymore. Right. But that's kind of a history lesson, and I think a lot of people get it. But what they don't really understand is how far your president and your country is going to go, because we see a huge and significant, you know, readiness exercises, military exercises by your country, China, off your, you know, you call it One China, of course, Taiwanese coast, and that you want, quote, peaceful reunification. But others see it as maybe it won't be so peaceful. Does your president have some reassurance after what President Biden told him last night? Or do you think it might devolve into a military, I don't know, showdown of some sort in sometime in the future?
First of all, it's very encouraging that President Biden reassured everyone of the One China policy. This is the most important thing. Now, the other thing is that the U.S. practice regarding Taiwan is conflicting itself, because what the United States has been doing recently adds more fuel to the fire of certain political forces in Taiwan, which demand moving towards independence of Taiwan. Now, this is the red line. This is the point of no return. What President Xi Jinping told President Biden very emphatically is that there is a point of no return. Don't go over that point, because if anyone pushes the situation beyond that point of no return, then China's mainland will be left with no other choice but to liberate Taiwan. That is kind of resumption of the civil war. And I don't think the United States want to be caught up in the civil war between different factions of China and place the bet in the wrong way. You are talking about two sides of Taiwan Strait, which cannot be divided by any force in the world.
Let me move over to you, Robert Daly, because obviously the Taiwan issue takes up a lot of oxygen. And I don't know whether that's the intention of the United States, which from the previous administration and the previous administration before that have wanted to deal with things like trade and jobs and the economy and other such issues. So do you think the United States, President Biden, achieved anything in those other major points, whether it's climate, because this comes right after the COP summit, whether it's on trade and the other major issues, including human rights?
No, we really didn't see any breakthroughs. President Biden did make his position on human rights very clear to Xi Jinping, who, of course, understood the position before the summit, just as President Biden understands China's positions on Taiwan perfectly well. Both sides were playing in part to domestic constituencies. It's very important to Xi Jinping that he be seen within China by the Communist Party, by the military, by the people, as a strong and unwavering leader. It's very important to President Biden that he not be seen, especially by the Republicans, as in any way weak on China. So these conversations that they have, these statements that they make, are for each other secondarily. Mostly they are for domestic political constituencies. And those constituencies in both countries are pushing leaders toward more hardline views.
Well, let me follow up then, because the former Deputy Secretary of State and now head of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, has written a long article in the run-up to this summit about, you know, what is a Biden doctrine? What is the Biden foreign policy? But about China, he points out that actually the Biden administration has largely maintained its predecessor's policy, predecessor being Trump. Biden himself has spoken of extreme competition with China. His coordinator for Indo-Pacific Affairs has proclaimed that, quote, the period that was broadly described as engagement has come to an end. So which is it? Is it extreme competition? Has engagement failed? Or what now, Robert Daly?
Well, I think I don't think that engagement failed. I think that engagement was a largely successful approach to China from 1979 until 2010 or 2012. China actually was moving under Deng Xiaoping, with the exception of the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, and under Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, toward greater personal freedom, toward greater integration, toward greater openness. What has changed is that China has succeeded economically. It's become wealthy. It has not surprisingly wanted to translate that wealth into greater power and greater global influence. And as it has done that, it has developed interests and pursued interests, some of which had always been in within the Chinese rubrics, but they hadn't pursued them quite as vigorously. It's been pursuing interests that are incommensurate with America's interests. So we have a real security dilemma in the Western Pacific. Real interests are invoked. This is not just a question of America fearing that it loses its hegemony or America having a Cold War mentality. We really do have incommensurate interests, especially in the Western Pacific. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is about. We're competing to shape global order, security architectures, trade and financial regimes. Very importantly, we're competing to shape technology, its development, its regulation. And that's now baked in the cake. It's not really China's fault or the United States' fault. But that is what President Biden is responding to. And that's why he's responding in many ways as President Trump did, because they're responding to the same developments.
Really, really interesting. So finally to you, Mr. Gao, because this comes right as your president, Xi Jinping, has been anointed by the party to basically have a third term, very unusual, and put up there on a pedestal with Chairman Mao himself. So given what Mr. Daly has just said, this inevitable competition is going to continue. How do you see it playing out then?
First of all, President Xi Jinping in China is highly popular, very much supported, and people do trust him as the leader of China. I don't think he will just serve for another third term. He may serve all the way up to 2035. So many, many years of leadership under Xi Jinping in China. Now, if we talk about China-US competition, we need to raise a very fundamental question. What do they compete for? Now, you may say China competes with the United States for the size of the number one economy in the world. No, that's not competition. Eventually, China will be larger than the United States. I think the key is that the United States may consider itself to be the top dog of the world, and China has no desire, no willingness to replace the United States as the top dog. Why? Because we see no fun in replacing the United States as the top dog of the world.
Okay. That's interesting, and we appreciate your perspective. Thank you very much indeed, Victor Gao and Robert Daly. Now, turning to one of Hollywood's biggest names, which is also now a top theatrical name, because thanks to a play that goes hilarious, of course, J.J. Abrams is the force behind blockbusters like the new Star Wars films. But you might not know that he's also the man who took a play that was first performed over a London pub to four paying customers and brought it all the way to New York. It's called The Play That Goes Wrong, but it's actually a global smash. More than 2 million people have seen it in 30 countries, and as it reopens off-Broadway, J.J. Abrams joins us now from Santa Monica, California. So welcome to the program. Thank you for being with us. And everybody wants to know what you're doing in the theatrical world. Is this a first for you?
It is, and thanks for having me. I was in London working on a film, and on a weekend was just sort of overwhelmed and feeling a bit depressed, frankly. And this was long before the pandemic. And I looked to see what was playing, and there was this thing called The Play That Goes Wrong, which I'd never heard of. And I bought a ticket, and I went to go see it. And I don't remember laughing so hard in the first half of a play. And at the intermission, I happened to meet one of the producers. And I heard myself say to him, if you ever want to take this to Broadway, as if I'd done that before. Let's talk. It would be great to help do that. And we did talk, and it ended up happening, frankly, much to my shock.
So let's just set it out, and I'll let you set it out. It's kind of like a murder mystery that kind of gets upended. I want to read what the New York Times said about it, which I think is pretty hilarious. He said, I propose putting your rational mind into sleep mode, the better to savor tickling images of order-inverting bizarreness. There's a wild redeeming poetry in such anarchy. Is that a fair take?
I think it is. I mean, look, the thing about it is, and perhaps now more than ever, the sheer absurdity of it. It takes something, it is sort of a bull in a china shop. The china shop is this murder mystery, as you say, and it's a very sort of classic British murder mystery. And then things just go insane. And what's so much fun about it is it's got such a big heart. And the people who put it together, the Mischief Theater Company, they're these just absolutely brilliant writers and performers. And the thing is done with such love and passion. And I just think that the audience feels it. And I can't think of something that people need more than to laugh in this moment. And The Play That Goes Wrong certainly does that.
Well, I was going to ask you, because laughter is such a nonpartisan event, right? Laughter doesn't know the difference between different party affiliations. So that's great.
Well, that's such a good point. I just want to say that, like, especially now in this age of you know, sort of silos and everyone staring at their phones and being, you know, the world seems so divisive and when you come together in a room with strangers, it doesn't matter, like you say, what your party affiliation is, what your religion is, what your background is, nothing. You're in that room and you're reminded that we are all much more similar than not. And it's a beautiful, and for The Play That Goes Wrong, a really fun thing to experience.
So I just want to broaden out because I would be, you know, unforgiven by the audience if I didn't go into some of your film work and some of the stuff that you're going to be doing. But first I want to know, because your biography that I read basically says that you had planned to go to dental school until you saw the light and decided to go to film school. Is that true?
No. And by the way, someone else said that to me. And I said,
okay, we're going to take it out
I thought,
of that.
I thought that would be such an interesting story. I should just say that that's true. But no, I've never been to dental school. But
No, you haven't. But you might have wanted to go. Was that ever something in your wish list?
No.
Okay, fine. Let's move on.
I have no idea where this came from. No. Okay.
Let's move on. So
the interview that goes wrong. That's what this is.
Yeah, the interview that goes wrong. No, it's the biography that was wrong, and we're going to call them out. In fact, we just
have. That's it.
So let me ask you something. Our parent company, Warner Media, has just done a deal with you, or you've done a deal with them, worth a huge amount of money to go into the production with them. So what I want to ask you about is, you know, things like, and it's an exclusive deal, you can go presumably to the DC Comics sandbox and to all that stuff which is so successful right now. After Star Wars and Mission Impossible and reviving so many franchises, is that what you intend to do? Would that be something interesting for you?
Well, we are Bad Robot, which is our production company. We're working on a number of projects. We're doing some projects that are in this area of the DC universe that's known as the Justice League Dark. It's particularly exciting. I personally am writing and directing a series for HBO that we shoot in the spring. That's an original story that is not part of DC, but as a company, we are producing a couple projects for television and a couple for features that originated with DC characters.
Well, you're producing a new Superman, aren't you, with Ta-Nehisi Coates? And I just wondered, you know, what you can tell us about that movie? How will it differ? It's really interesting that you're doing it with Ta-Nehisi and raises the possibility that there could be a black Superman.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that while it's too early to talk specifics about the story, I will say that working with Ta-Nehisi is a remarkable thing. I mean, he is not just, you know, such a brilliant author. He is a huge comic book nerd, which is my favorite thing. And though he grew up much more a Marvel kid than a DC kid, his love of this character and his insight and his ideas, I can't remember working with someone and being so inspired every time we talk, every time we meet. So I will say that it's something that I could not be more excited about.
Well, he really is a conversation shaper these days, and he's very influential. And I know you don't want to talk about details, but he's not just writing the same old Superman, and you're not just producing, I presume, the same old Superman. Do you have any vision of how it might differ from other Superman movies?
Well, I will say that the ideas that Ta-Nehisi has, you know, there are some really wonderful big swings. And again, I don't want to get him upset with me and talk publicly about things that are premature. But I will say that the story does feel like a version of Superman that we have not seen before. And I can't think of someone more, that more exciting as an author for this piece than Ta-Nehisi.
Well, you've already given us a little bit to chew on right now. It'd be interesting to see what you both come up with. But I want to ask you, and I hope I haven't got this quote wrong, J.J. Abrams, but I'm going to throw this quote at you because it's you, several years ago, apparently saying, I feel like in telling stories, there are the things the audience thinks are important, and then there are the things that are actually important. First of all, did you say that? And what do you actually mean in terms of storytelling?
I think I might have said that in dental school. but what I think I meant, and later when I was sober, what I realized was that there are things in stories that when I think sometimes stories get if something's successful, often you see, and this is nothing new in sort of any business, but you see ripoffs and inspired by stories. And a lot of times the thing that people are copying, the thing that people are retelling or trying to do are the things that are the sort of big sort of either the action of it or the genre of it, the stuff that is kind of more artifice or aesthetic. And the thing that makes something really powerful is what's inside, the characters and their internal lives. And so when a movie like Jaws or, you know, any successful movie comes out, Die Hard, you know, whatever, you see dozens of ripoffs of that kind of a thing. And I think what happens quite often is that people are copying what they think made the thing successful. And usually the thing at the heart of it, the core of it, was something much more intimate. So, for example, with Back to the Future, which is just one of the great movies of all time, you know, those writers, Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale, when they first started working on that, they were interested in telling a story about what would happen if you, as a teenager, met your mother as a teenager. Like, what would you have thought of her then? Like, there was no DeLorean, there was no time travel at first. It was just kind of this idea that was a very sort of intimate, primal idea. And so I think that's what I meant when I said that, period.
And in context of that, and now I do know this because it was on 60 Minutes, Spielberg said that he recommended that you direct those episodes, if I could say, of Star Wars, the last of the three there. How much of a mind-blowing experience was that for you? I mean, how much did you like doing that? It's so iconic and seared into everybody's minds.
Well, I'll tell you, it's definitely a double-edged sword for a lot of reasons, but I will say that the opportunity, and Steven was absolutely a champion in this, and I'm grateful to him for more things than I can count, but that was certainly one of them. And to Kathy Kennedy, who gave me the job, I will say that it was absolutely an honor, and it was a surreal thing to step in. And there are, you know, obviously things about doing those movies that are far more complicated and things that I probably, you know, will never be able to talk about publicly because it's just so, it was such an overwhelming experience to do them, you know, on both sides of the coin.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you. And thank you so much, J.J. Abrams, who never, ever planned to go to dental school. And thank God. We've been talking about the rise of autocrats around the world, and our next guest is not afraid to call one of them out. She is Rachel Vindman, whose husband, Alexander, was thrust into the national spotlight after blowing the whistle on President Donald Trump's alleged abuse of power. And in her new podcast, The Suburban Women Problem, she talks about how her breakup with the Republican Party represents a larger trend of suburban women following suit. Here she is speaking to Michelle Martin.
Thanks, Christiane. Rachel Vindman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is an honor.
So you're living your life, your military spouse. You're obviously very proud of your husband's service and the work that he's doing. You've lived in countries around the world. Mm-hmm. You're back here. And all of a sudden, like, everything changes for you. It just, mm-hmm. Could you just walk us through, like, those first few days where you realized, holy cow, like this is a tsunami coming at us. Like, what was that like?
The first few days were pretty awful. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There was a lot of support, an onslaught of support, of course, but then the trolls started coming. And a little bit before that, my husband was called in by the chief of staff of the Army, General James McConville. And at that moment, that conversation, when he told me what happened in that conversation, I knew that his career in the Army was over. It took him a lot longer to realize it, but I could tell from what General McConville said to him, what he didn't say, I knew his career was over. And then the next day is really when Don Jr. started in, and there was someone else online who was saying some things that weren't true. And Alex is an extremely forgiving person. And he's like, look, Rachel, this person, he's a combat veteran. You know, maybe there's more going on. It's not true. Let's just leave it. It'll just go away. And then the next day, the president was going somewhere. He actually quoted the guy or alluded to the allegations that were being made. And I just thought, you know, I was trying to tell him, it doesn't matter what the truth is. Have you not been watching? Have you not been paying attention for the past, you know, 3 years that this man has been, you know, in the public, well, you know, that he's been running for president and president? The truth is immaterial. If they want to destroy you, if they want to destroy us, they will, and nothing else will matter. So it was very, very scary.
So what was that like for you? I mean, were you like checking your phone constantly to see like what latest terrible thing was being said? Were your friends all calling you to ask you if you were okay? Like, what was that like for you?
Yes. I mean, and you know, at that point, I think we enjoyed, you know, a lot of bipartisan support, because even the attacks that were made on Alex, I mean, people knew it was patently untrue, even if they disagreed with what he did or how he did it. But, you know, because he was a member of the military in service, he certainly couldn't do media and speak out. So it was very hard to not have the truth out, to not be able for someone to be making allegations and saying about you and just having zero ability to respond. And that was really frustrating to me. At the same time, I know the truth. I know who we are. And because, you know, throughout our relationship and time together, that has been tested. We've had to lean on each other a lot of times. So I found, you know, comfort in that. And of course, you know, my close family and friendships, but it was frustrating. Very, very frustrating.
Were you ever afraid? Because one of the things these trolls are known to do is threaten people.
Many times I was afraid. So definitely after the closed door testimony, and then after the public testimony, in particular, there were Senator Marsha Blackburn's tweets, which the very witty Vindman is the whistleblower's handler, and other comments like that. She really has a way with words, but those comments, especially as stupid as they were, definitely led to an uptick in rhetoric and threats. We did get some letters to our house, and we definitely, our local community, you know, the Army made sure that we, you know, have protection, but I was very, very scared for my husband's safety. When he would go to work, I was afraid for him at work and his work environment, because they knew everywhere he was going and what he would do. I didn't even know the extent of it, which is probably best until later, of all the ways that they were making his life very miserable. And but fortunately, I guess they left us out of it at home.
So now you've made the decision to actually keep speaking out. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. You've become a columnist for USA Today. You have a podcast, which we're going to talk about in a minute, where you kind of grapple with some of these issues. You know, some people would just kind of like, I'm done with this. When that chapter is closed, you're like, please close the door again. I never want to talk about politics and I'll just disappear. That was not your choice. Tell me more about that. Like, why?
Because this moment, this fight that we have is ongoing, and I have a platform, and I think it's my duty to use my platform to speak out.
What are you feeling right now?
it's difficult. This is always a difficult question for me to answer, of the why. And I guess, you know, as I said in my first USA Today column, just the most authentic version of myself right now. I feel that I can't just sit on the sidelines. This is the country that I love. I gave up my career ambitions. I gave up a lot when I married Alex to be a military spouse. And I did so gladly because I thought it was an extension of his service to our country. And I know a lot of military spouses feel that way. But when I realized that just a regular person's voice could have a difference, I felt I had to use it.
How did the podcast start?
So the podcast is really just women talking to women and having discussions. And that is something I can completely relate to. And I often liken it to, you know, our bus stop moms group. So, you know, people have come and gone and moved. My daughter's in fifth grade. I've been doing the bus stop thing for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone comes from different backgrounds and they're different political views, but we have one really key thing in common is that we all have children. They go to the same school and we care about them a lot. That's a pretty big base from which, you know, you can talk about a lot of things on that level. And if you talk about, you know, you start disagreeing as you build up, then I respect those women that I have made those relationships with so much. And I think that there's a place there that we can talk to each other and even have the hard conversations. And I think as a nation, we can do that as well. But I really like to focus on women. It's where I feel most comfortable. I also, in addition to the podcast, I am on the advisory board of the Renew Democracy Initiative, which is a bit more highbrow, I guess, but I mean, in terms of, you know, what they're trying to do, but I feel like that's a place where I can still be me and, you know, still bring my unique perspective, which is, democracy is being attacked and how can we get people to understand that's happening? And again, I feel like it's easiest through conversation.
Well, let's dig into that for a minute here, because that is the vantage point a lot of people are fascinated by. I mean, first of all, just how Donald Trump got elected to begin with. Like, how do you understand that? A lot of people still feel like, well, wait a minute, you had the most qualified woman probably in history, probably the most qualified candidate in history. And people are like, nah. And pick somebody who had never held public office, had a terrible reputation for racism and misogyny. So let's just start there. Like, how do you understand that?
I had definitely already been moving away from the Republican Party. That goes without saying, I guess. But it's not something that only when it happened to my family. I didn't have the sense of immediacy. I didn't have an appreciation for how dire the situation was. And, you know, to the question, why did I think this, how did it land with me? And was I surprised? I mean, yes. Since then, what I have learned is a lot of people in our country don't feel heard. And right, wrong, or indifferent, Donald Trump made them feel like someone was listening to them. A lot of people feel very left behind and no one is answering their questions. No one is talking to them.
Let's fast forward to an election that just happened. And I think you live in Virginia.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And this is one of those races that people were paying a lot of attention to. It was, you know, Virginia is a state that Biden won handily. And, mm-hmm. you know, 2 years later, Glenn Youngkin, another businessman, first time candidate, you know, kind of really leaned in on issues that, frankly, some other people considered racist or at least race baiting. So I just want to point out that Glenn Youngkin, there was a 13-point swing from where among white women from Joe Biden just 2 years earlier. I mean, two years later, Glenn Youngkin, as I understand it, won 57% of white women's votes in Virginia compared to 43% for McAuliffe. This is according to NBC's exit polling. So what do you think happened there?
I think that Terry McAuliffe didn't talk to the voters. When he made the gaffe that he said he was not going to have parents in school, the campaign's response was to have an ad that primarily had teachers. And I sent an email and I said, well, have you thought about doing an ad with parents, the response from parents? And, you know, I got an email back. Thank you for your feedback. And that was it. And then
thank you for your feedback.
Yes. It's humbling always, right? And then the organization that does my podcast, Red, Wine, and Blue, which has been, they were very active in this election and helping actually local school board candidates. Is that if you know 72% of school board candidates who ran against crazy right wing like anti-CRT nonsense, they won. 72% of the people won. But you know how they won? They won because they addressed the concerns of the parents. So we made an ad, very low budget. I mean, it was a good ad. And the campaign actually took their ad off with the teachers and put the ad of Virginia moms on. But I think it was just too late to really make a difference. But, you know, fundamentally, I think, unfortunately, former Governor McAuliffe didn't listen to people and didn't talk to them. Because, you know, here's the deal, Michelle. When people are scared, they're scared, whether it's a real fear or not, whether it's the culture war, CRT, whatever the case may be. You can't just say that doesn't exist, so we're not going to talk about it. You have to, you know, meet people where they are. You have to talk to people, whether it's individuals talking to people, politicians also have to talk to people and understand what they want.
You have been very open about the fact that you have left the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. You said that that was kind of a long time coming. And after what happened to you and your husband and your family, it really wasn't much of a choice. But at the end of the day, are you more disappointed with the Republicans or the Democrats at this point? Because you've had some words about the Democrats too.
That's a tough question. I'm disappointed in people who don't see the urgency to protect democracy. So the Renew Democracy Initiative just published a letter signed by, I think it's 50 dissidents from 30 countries around the world who are looking at the United States, screaming, shouting, jumping up and down, saying, there's a shark behind you, get out of the water. And people are still floating around, you know, playing around and splashing around. And people are trying to warn us. They're on the shore. They've been there. They understand. And we're still going along like nothing is happening and everything is okay. And I guess in some ways, I may be on the shore also because I feel that what happened to my family, although it's probably not going to happen, I mean, that's a very like specific instance, but I think norms are being eroded. People are being attacked and you're not listening. You're just going on with life because, hey, the economy is okay and it's probably going to be all right. And, you know, this
or maybe I have what I want, so I don't care.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
I want to read from one of the things she wrote in one of your columns. She said, as is the case with many, I identify as a one-issue voter at this time. When I look at a ballot, the only thing I see is a choice between democracy and a slide toward authoritarianism. Those are very strong words. I mean, unfortunately, we've been hearing them so much over the last few years that perhaps it doesn't strike people as alarmingly as it might have 5 years ago or even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But what can people do?
They need to vote. That's really important. But engage, learn what your elected leaders are saying. I would hope that people are just absolutely appalled by this nonsense of, you know, ask your elected leaders, what are you doing? What are you doing to protect democracy? What are you doing for accountability for January 6th? Meaningful things. What is being done? Are we ever going to have accountability for the, you know, complete tragedy that we saw on January 6th, the attack on our democracy? How many more warnings do you need? And I think, you know, people need to, if they believe in something, if they believe that democracy is worth saving, if they believe that we need leaders of integrity, and they need to go out and advocate for it. We had, you know, people who were helping with the McAuliffe campaign. I mean, good candidate or not, again, it goes back to this choice. Or is it someone who's going to talk about election integrity? I mean, Glenn Youngkin would not admit that the 2020 election was legitimate. That's a deal breaker for me. I don't care what he promised to do. And that right there, we're done. But, you know, so we needed more people, but people were saying, maybe he's not that bad. He'll be okay. No, if you can't admit that a free and fair election was indeed free and fair, and that we should have had a peaceful transition to power, which we didn't, then you're not the candidate for me. And more people need to just say that, like, I'm not even going to engage with you. I'm not even going to listen to what you feel on what you say, if we can't agree on very basic things. But, you know, I don't know what Glenn Youngkin personally believes. Maybe he doesn't believe that, as some people have tried to say, but the fact that he was willing to go along with it, I mean, if you can't stand up for basic things and get elected, then I don't think you deserve to be an elected official of the United States of America.
But you're also critical of the Democrats. I mean, you write in USA Today, in a piece that's published just this morning, you wrote, too often when a former Republican, future former Republican, never Trumper, says something objectionable to a Democrat, their loyalty is immediately questioned. They are loyal to democracy and willing to put in the time and effort to defeat Trumpism. More importantly, if we are going to win, we need their votes. Tell me more about that.
Every single day on Twitter, someone tells me that I'm not progressive enough, that I'm new to the party, and that I maybe because of that shouldn't have such a say. And it's not, I mean, it's not just me. I'm, I guess, a bigger target, but I see people saying it to others all the time. And it's, there's so many people who have jumped on to help. You know, it'll be great when we get back to talking about tax rates and, you know, other, like those halcyon days of, you know, how much should we spend on the military, et cetera, et cetera. So, but that's not where we are now. And it's going to take everyone to win this fight. This fight is the fight. This is still the fight for the soul of America, because the soul of America is democracy. And that's still what we're fighting for. So that's why it's going to take everyone. And if everyone is going to be on the team, everyone needs to feel like they're a valued member of the team, or they might just not show up to the game. And that's the worst thing that can happen.
Rachel Binman, thank you so much for talking with us. I hope we'll talk again, and somehow I suspect that we will.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
And that's it for now. Goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.